My name is Scott Redmond, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. And I was actually born a couple of blocks from Yankee Stadium, and my sons get a big kick out of it because I seem to have avoided any spiritual principles when it comes to sports on any level at all. And I've got a George Steinbrenner problem, and so if you're a Yankee fan, no, I'm kidding. That was clearly Satan working through me, and I blacked out during that moment. I don't even know what the hell happened. I like to congratulate the guy who won the contest tonight, the guy with the least time. You won, and hope you never win again. Hope you never win again. I have been to conferences, and I know a lot of people who have been to a lot of conferences know this, that there are some people who are forbidden from taking the book again because they've been taking the book so many times. So I hope you never win again. You kind of looked like you'd been elected most attractive man on your cell block there. It looked, it's kind of an honor, but you don't know, you know, is this a good thing or a bad thing? Do I want to pick up the trophy? You know, that kind of thing. So. I'm really nutty from traveling. I've been here for like a minute and a half, so I'm glad you're here to help me make sense out of this. And man, this speaking thing is kind of like being in a rock band with no music. At any rate, I want to welcome the new people to AA. I want to tell you, all I've got is good news. I'm just here to talk about the good news tonight. I got no bad news. All I got is good news. And it's a pleasure and an honor to be part of your celebration tonight. And if you're new, I want to welcome you to AA. If I'm a little wacky and I get boring, I'll just start out. I'll tell you my favorite story about being bored in Alcoholics Anonymous. There was a guy in my old home group, the North Hollywood group in L.A., named Jeff D., and he's been sober a long time now, but when he was new, he was at our home group, and he was shifting around in his seat, and his sponsor said to him, "What's the matter?" He said, "I'm bored." And his sponsor said, "Well, you know why you're bored." And Jeff said, "No." His sponsor said, "You're bored because you're boring." And it was like an acid moment for him. He went, "Wow." It like freaked him out, you know? And he thought, what a cool thing to say to a newcomer, you know? He thought it was a great thing. So he can hardly wait till the newcomer tells him that they're bored. 13 years later, no newcomer has told him that they're bored. And he's at our home group with a young lady who was brand new, and she was shifting around in her seat, and he said, "What's the matter?" She said, "I'm bored." He said, "Well, you know why you're bored?" She said, "Yeah, because I'm with you." That's why. So welcome, welcome, welcome. If you're new to AA, if you're a drug addict, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're a dope fiend, which is somehow worse than any of us, welcome to AA. If you're a crack monster or the Bigfoot of dope addicts, a dope Goliath, welcome to AA. I'd like to welcome all the tweakers. Welcome, tweakers. Right? You don't even remember why you just started clapping, do you? But welcome. I love you guys. If you've ever masturbated till you're dehydrated, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. That was worth it just because I got Vinoy to go. There's no one to tell on me. Oh, there's telephones, aren't there? I'm not making fun of you. I'm coming close, and I'll tell you why. I don't care what you've got. I don't care if you're a crack monster. I don't care if you're like an energizing crack bunny. I don't care. Just catch alcoholism. Catch alcoholism. We'd love to give it to you. I did not have alcoholism when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. I didn't. I caught alcoholism in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. I did not. My sponsor used to say that, that the infection enters through the ear, and you get a mild case, and now I have a horrible case of alcoholism. But I did not have alcoholism when I came here, for a lot of reasons. Number one, I'm Jewish, and Jews don't drink. Because it might dull the pain. And you certainly don't want to squander any agony opportunity. In addition to the Judaism, I couldn't possibly have been alcoholic because I had been in psychotherapy for 18 years. I was going to be dead, but I was going to understand it. And I'm not putting therapy down. I got no beef with therapy. I've used therapy plenty in sobriety, much to my betterment. My colossal mistake is I was trying to treat my alcoholism with psychotherapy, which is like showing up at a gunfight with a knife. It's just an unbelievably bad idea. I mean, the idea of conventional therapy is to uncover, discover, and unravel. In Freudian therapy, you might talk about your past, you might shed some light on these things and free associate, and if you're neurotic, I don't know if anybody here has ever been referred to as a neurotic. If you're neurotic, that means you have anxiety, right? You have anxiety, and you come up with a solution for the anxiety, and it sucks. The solution sucks. It's a bad solution. So your solutions are worse than your problems. I don't know if that resonates in this group at all. And so you have anxiety. You resolve it terribly. You create more anxiety, and that's a neurosis. So you're going to therapy to come up with a better solution, a better resolution for your anxiety. So I'm in therapy. I feel terrible. Why? Well, I was so drunk yesterday. I was too drunk to walk, so I drove. Well, what are we going to do about that? Hey, let's talk about it. Let's talk. What were you thinking just before you did it? Nothing. Nothing. I feel terrible. Why? Yesterday I sharpened a hypodermic needle on the back of a matchbook striker and sucked some heroin up through a fluffed up cigarette filter and injected it. I just feel miserable. What were you thinking just before you did it? Nothing. Nothing. Let's treat nothing. Because here's the deal. Some people might be repressing when they say nothing. They might be lying. We're telling the truth. Nothing! Nothing! The room spun, my brain got too big for my cranium, my mouth filled with saliva, I went out for a pack of cigarettes and wound up in Baltimore. Nothing. My wife and I, a guy lent us his car and we sold his car. We sold his car. I looked at my wife, I said, I'm so sick of being irresponsible. We are not borrowing money. We're going to stand on our own 2 feet. We're selling the car. And my wife looked at me with tears in her eyes, like, we've really arrived, you know? Okay. So I did not have alcoholism when I came to AA. If you do not have alcoholism and you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, I urge you to stick around until you get a diagnosis. Just stick around and get a diagnosis. But I will tell you this. If your alcoholism keeps going below the horizon and stops presenting itself as a real piece of business and you keep drinking again, I want to urge you to stick around and get a diagnosis, because there's only one kind of person I know in the world that happens to, whose alcoholism goes below. And if you know, what is alcoholism? It took me a long time in AA, and I'm still discovering what it is. But I basically know what it is, and it took me a long time. I have a physical reaction to alcohol that makes it impossible for me to control or enjoy or moderate once I begin. And if you're special and you're a drug addict, try some controlled crack smoking. Just fill your mouth up with crack smoke and say, I'm not in the mood, and blow it out. And And hats will fill the air. It'll look like graduation day at Annapolis, I guarantee you. And it's coupled with some bizarre thinking. It's referred to as alcoholic thinking. It's the source of a lot of mirth at Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. It's remarkable. I've heard the alcoholic mind described this way. I just love it so much. It's like the most perfectly tuned clock that keeps the most precise time in the universe for 1 minute. And then skips a century. That when it works, it's a gorgeous, rhapsodic thing. And when it doesn't, it leaves gaps large enough to move an entire culture through. And that's, it's baffling, because when it works, it seems to work quite well. And this thinking, I still have this thinking. I've had this thinking my whole life. And it's the reason why I do more, 19 and a half years in AA, I do more in AA now than I ever have before. And that's who I've hung out with since I've gotten sober. Guys and gals who, when things get good, they do more, and when things get bad, they do more, so that when things get bad, they don't gotta do more. They're already doing it. Those are the people who I've hung out with for my whole sobriety. Because if I don't treat this thinking, my alcoholism will go below the horizon and stop presenting itself as a real piece of business. A couple of years ago, I was about 14 years sober, and I needed some surgery on my hand, and I went to this doctor. He said, you know, Mr. Redmond, you're going to need general anesthetic with this particular surgery. And I said, general anesthetic? That's great. Normal people don't get excited about general anesthetic. There's no normal person that goes, oh, general anesthetic. I'll tell you why I get excited, for two reasons. Number one, I leave the surgery out. I leave that's out completely. That's not involved. I leave out the pain, the sutures, the recovery, the bleeding. That's gone, you know. And I know something about general anesthetic. When they hit you with it, they say, count backwards from 100. And you go, 199. And I love 99. Love 99. A couple of years after this, about 16 years sober, and I was seeing another doctor, and he said, you know, Mr. Redmond, the surgery you had on your hand, you need it on the other hand, too. And I said, I guess we'll be having some of that general anesthetic then. And he looked at me and said, you don't need general anesthetic with that surgery. And I immediately thought, no, I need another goddamn doctor is what I need. Now, right now. We need a second opinion. Now. And I have this bizarre reaction to alcohol that only takes place in a certain class of people, a certain allergic class, and I keep drinking because I have this wacky thinking, and I develop this cancer of the soul, this spiritual tapeworm that ate me up from the inside and left me hollow and insane and alone, and I was dying from it, and I was killing the people around me, and I didn't even know I had it. I didn't even know I had it, and I had it practicing it from the age of 14 through 33, so it doesn't surprise me that it took a while to get a diagnosis. I'm surprised I got it as quickly as I did, you know. I grew up in the Bronx in New York City. You forgot that you're on the witness protection program, didn't you? No, damn. No, I'm not. I just like the word. Oops. I love when I'm in Montana and Tony's there. I love that. Yeah, I love the prairie. Been here my whole life. I've seen those guys up there. They shouldn't put them up there. They shouldn't. To a completely insane family. My family is a very, very troubled group of people. They are still insane. My wife never believed me about them until she met them. And my mom threw an engagement party for us, and my Aunt Rose came and wore her wig backwards. And it had a bun on it. And it was a look she was going after. She wore it beret style, sort of jauntily askew. It looked like a Todd Browning film, or a David Lynch film, actually, now. I had understated the problem. I had not, you don't brag about this stuff. If you got anything for free in my family, it meant it was stolen. And I had an uncle who was a welder who used to get free bales of steel wool. What? Here's your paycheck and your complimentary bale of steel wool. What the hell is that about? And my aunt took a decorating course and made throw pillows and filled all the throw pillows with the plentiful and free steel wool. Now, that stuff works its way through on you after a while. And when you'd look at the room, everybody was moving a little bit, you know? The whole room was like a pulsing living organism. And as a little kid, you really look out and you go, there's something way off here, way off. There was chronic institutionalization and suicide attempts. One of my relatives was committed to the back wards at Grasslands in New York, which is horrifying. And I had relatives who had have people watch them when they took a bath so they wouldn't take themselves out. We had a lot of trouble, a lot of bad stuff, and a lot of mental and physical abuse. And if you're new here, all I've got is good news for you, because my family didn't make me an alcoholic. They injured me terribly. And I'm not telling you I haven't had to do a lot of stuff to take care of that injury, but I'm telling you they didn't make me an alcoholic. I have this bizarre physical reaction, this insane thinking, and a spiritual sickness. And the funny thing is the real problem is the spiritual sickness. That's really what has plucked me beyond the opportunity of being helped by well-meaning clergy and people in the medical profession, people who love me, careers that wanted me to be part of their business. And if you're new, the architecture of this fifth wheel, the architecture that brings you this meeting tonight, because without the treatment of the spiritual experience, this room's empty. The architecture of it is described in the fifth chapter of our book. It's described throughout our book, but it's really beaten out in that chapter. And it says that the innards of it are resentments, the defects of character that fuel the resentments, fears, and sexual misconduct. I'm sure this is such good news for the new people. Because you see, I don't just hate stuff. I re-experience the hatred in a way that is so detrimental to me, I can't even have a life with it. I hate things so that when I wake up, I water the hatred like a little flower. I make sure that it's okay, it's getting enough light and enough water, and it's doing well. The worst thing is when I forget to hate something, you know, and a guy goes, hi, and I go, hi, oh, I hate him, why did I do that? Damn, now I'm gonna have to like re-snub him, you know? And re-snubbing takes a while. It takes a while. You gotta make sure you run into him, but not really deliberately, so you're not looking to re-snub him. You kind of re-snub him in a who cares enough about you to even snub you kind of thing. I hate so that when my head hits the pillow, it becomes a rotisserie. I go mad. It eats my brain and my heart and turns my life black and throws me out of my own life. And I didn't know that that was my problem. I would have been very surprised to know that. And I grew up in this family, this crazy family. Because I got to tell you, I had good therapy. If my family had made me an alcoholic, the therapy would have worked. I had good therapy. But I was going to be dead with no Oedipal conflict, but really dead. And I didn't want to be an alcoholic. I started drinking really young. I dropped out of junior high school. I hit the ground running, and I did not want to be a drunk. I tried to join a gang. I failed the test. And I went across the street. There was a induction post for the hippies at that time, and they had no written test. And I was accepted immediately. And I'm going to talk about drugs, and I don't mean to upset anybody. I'm talking about them as applied to my alcoholism, and I really didn't come all this way to piss anybody off. And if my talk upsets you, it's not my intention. And if it does, please tell Stumpy. Don't come to allegedly thank me and straighten me out. Not that that's ever happened to me. One guy came up to me after my talk and said, "Why do you hate AA?" And I said, "I don't hate AA. I hate you." I'm good to go with AA. You're pissing me off pretty good, though. But I overcame my alcohol problem with marijuana. I'd like to welcome all the pot smokers here tonight. You remember WOW, right? Oh, stop it. You remember WOW, don't you?
WOW.
Right after WOW usually came, what? What? Wow, what? Wow, what? Wow, what? Wow, what? Wow, what? Wow, what? Watching a pot smoker is like watching a dog try to run on linoleum. There's like, that's a good sign. Did you see her? That was fantastic. She's got the claws out on her. Oh. There's a lot of activity, but no movement. But I overcame my marijuana problem with pills. I loved speed. I almost licked all the features off my own face. One winter. My wife, as always, remarked, said, "You're the only speed freak I know who remained a pig." You know, because speed freaks sometimes clean up. I managed to miss that whole part of being a speed freak. I overcame that problem with cocaine. Cocaine is an excellent drug. It's particularly good for sex, if you enjoy sex from the Neolithic period. And I kicked that gall darn cocaine with heroin. Heroin's a very dark, complicated, artistic drug. And then you cross the line and become a vomiting pig. It's just a little hop, skip, and a jump. And I drank until I didn't want to be a drunk, and got dropped out of junior high school, got thrown out of other schools, had a really tough time, got government money to go back to school. Life was horrible, and I started developing a life in show business. I just got a job in a hardware store and put myself through acting school when I was a little kid, and I started this life that has gone on for years and years and years. And I was in a cycle where I was using intravenous drugs. I was shots and dope, got on the West Side Highway to hitchhike down in Manhattan. My aunt and uncle picked me up in a car. It took me to the hospital. My father had had a massive stroke that day, and I was taken to the hospital, and I couldn't show up for him the day that he died. And I mean, I couldn't show up. The curtain was down, and I felt like a pig, like an animal. I had holes in my arms, and I couldn't even go into the room and touch him on the cheek and give him a kiss and tell him I love him and watch him take his light into another room. The ice around my heart was so thick already. First of all, my father wasn't moving on anywhere. He was going to die and rot, and that was all she wrote. That's the life I was leading by that time. I had so rearranged my life to accommodate alcoholism by that time. That stuff wasn't even in my vocabulary. And I couldn't bear the agony that day. I couldn't fit the pain in my head. I couldn't possibly be this monster who couldn't even get it together the day that his dad died. My dad was a great guy. And I knew what the problem was. I had to figure it out pretty quick. And the problem was needles and heroin. And all I had to do was never put a needle in my arm again, and I wouldn't be the guy who couldn't show up for his old man. So I didn't, not for 13 years. Shortly after that, I was acting in a Broadway play, and a new usherette with long brown hair walked in, and I took one look at her, and I didn't even say hello to her. I didn't say hi to her. I walked back into the dressing room, I stood up on a chair, and I announced to the male members of this cast that if anybody talked to her, I would break all the bones in their hands and feet. And this June, we'll be married 29 years. And if you've been married a long time, you know one of the reasons is because we have never wanted to get divorced at the same time. That's just... Let's face it, kids. And we love each other very much. You know, if you're new, I want to tell you these resentments I was talking about. You know, I want to tell you the my favorite sentence in the Big Book of AA when I was new is in the fifth chapter. They're assuming that you've written a list of all the people that have screwed you, done you wrong, the guys and gals who fired you, and the relatives that have done you wrong, and the people who have walked out of relationships, and the people who are thinking behind your backs. You know, and then we write a defect list. We've been asked to write a list of our faults that really, without the faults, the resentment doesn't exist. Game over. They're done. They got no punch. And they assume that you've written the list. And then it says, if you're looking at the list, the first thing that was apparent was the world and its people were often quite wrong. That's enough for tonight. I don't think we need to read anything else. Because I tell you, don't read the next two pages. Because what the next two pages say is, you're right. They don't argue with a drunk. They never argue with a drunk in our book. They say, you're right. Unfortunately, you're dead. You're right, and you're dead. They've treated you terribly, and you're dead. Because you experience this wrongdoing in a way that is so injurious that it eclipses anything good in your life. It's gorgeous. It's a gorgeous formula. And then it shows you the way out, you know? And Nancy and I started our life together in New York. We had a great time. If you're new, you're going to hear some wacky stuff about alcoholism now that you're in AA. You'll hear it in and out of the program. I've heard stuff about alcoholism. Some of the stuff makes sense to me. Some of it doesn't. Some I find it annoying. Some not. I've never found the annoying stuff, the stuff that annoys me, in the Big Book of AA, ever. Never found it. And some of the stuff really works for some people. It just doesn't work for me. Like, I've heard that alcoholics don't like change. Don't like it. I don't like change I don't like. I've never heard anyone get to a podium and say, geez, I just hit the lottery. I'm having sex with identical twins. It's killing me. It's killing me. I don't know what the hell to do. I got to call my sponsor. I'm roasting on the embers of hell. I've heard that alcoholics are perfectionists. I'm a pig. I am not a perfectionist. There's only one time I become a perfectionist, and that is when my wife is caring for me. Then I seem to have explosive perfectionism. Other than that, I'm in pretty good shape. But my favorite, my absolute favorite, is that alcoholics are above average intelligence. I have only heard this at Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. I have never heard it anywhere else. I have never heard it at an Al-Anon meeting, ever. Oh, we're so smart. And one of the most misquoted and misused lines in the Big Book of AA, I've heard people say at meetings, my worst day in here is better than my best day out there. No. No. I really had such a great time out there. And let's see, a pound of cocaine in an all-female jazz band or a panel at the prison. I don't know. What do I want to do? What... Actually, what the guy says at the end of chapter 3, very beautifully, is he says, I wouldn't trade my worst day in here for my best day out there, because I won't trade this way of life. I won't take a nickel for today when I could have a quarter tomorrow. I won't live like a sucker anymore. I won't. Because my alcoholism isn't going below the horizon anymore. It's staying up as a real piece of business all the time, for the first time. And if you're new, I want to tell you something. This is one, for me, just for me, this is 100% about not drinking. The not drinking part is a moose. If it was not for the not drinking part, we would be a much bigger organization. I guarantee it. This room would be 8 times the size if it wasn't for that gall darn not drinking thing. Because it screws a lot of people up. And if you've been around here any appreciable amount of time, you know people who want the AA deal, but it's that damn not drinking thing. You know? And when I say it's all about not drinking for me, it's because it's the middle of the miracle. It's the single, it's the act, it's the demonstration, it's the thing that happened to me when I got here. The inexplicable, unexplainable thing that happened to me, that when I wanted to drink, I didn't. I didn't, and I continue to not, and you've shown me how. And if you're new here, we get excited. We get excited. You saw it during the countdown. We get so excited because you've got this opportunity. And sometimes people come in and they don't appreciate the gravity of the opportunity they've been afforded. And some of us do. So we say, try this, do this. Throw as much stuff into this hole that you can. Throw as much stuff into this window of opportunity that you can. We don't know that it's going to work. We don't. We really don't. At the end of the day, we don't. At the end of the day, this is a complete mystery. I believe the big book of AA, St. Thomas and the mystics. I believe them. No one can fully comprehend or define that power, which is God. This is an absolute mystery. I'm renewed daily by the radiance of a never-ending source of power beyond my comprehension. And that is a difficult thing to live with sometimes. So when I was new, I misidentified certain people and certain things and certain meetings as the source of the power instead of what they were, which is a reflection of it. And I need them. But I can't need them to be the source, because then I'm making a big mistake. And I'm injuring them, really, in the long run. I'm injuring them and myself. At any rate, Nancy and I had a great time. We just, she started becoming troubled from prolonged exposure to me. And she really became kind of crazy. And I've already told you about the car incident, which she supported me on. That's pretty crazy. We had our son Micah, who was really welcomed into the world, and 2 years and 9 months later, our son Jesse was born. And it was terrible. It was awful. As wonderful as the birth of our first child was, that's how miserable the birth of our second child was. We were surrounded by friends and family and got a ton of phone calls. And 2 years and 9 months later, when Jesse was born, nobody around, not even the grandparents, came down. And do you think it was because they didn't love us? No, they adored us. We're wonderful people. It hurt too much to be around us. We hadn't even paid the doctor. We might have even gotten thrown out of the hospital that day. Or transferred to county. It was too scary. It was just too awful. And, I had a moment that day, I know, because a couple of months before my wife gave birth, I found her crying in the bathroom, and I said, "What's the matter?" And she said, "I feel like I'm giving this baby cancer." From a spiritual sickness that we didn't even have. And I had a lot of reasons why she would feel that way, and none of them were the truth. By the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous on April 22nd, 1985, and that day that Jesse was born, that terrible day when I didn't think it could get any worse, and my careers were over, and my wife was insane, and nobody showed up at the hospital, and the baby was born sick, and he got born, we had more debt because we couldn't pay any of the hospital bills. And little were we to know that was going to continue for 3 more years. 3 more years. Our bottoms are unbelievable. And we've all seen it. I mean, I know that you probably have somebody or some bodies at your home group that just come in, they're surrendered. You can see it. You can see it. They get to the podium, share their gift with us, just get, radioactive and share their way out of the room, come back without an arm, now they got one arm, two legs, they get pissed off, they come back, they're like a stump, a pissed off stump, And you can't plumb the depths of the spiritual sickness, the power of this spiritual sickness. It's extraordinary. And we started out on Broadway, and I'll tell you where we wound up. This was a good day in the Redmond home. I was a couple of months before I got sober. I got into an accident. They took me to the hospital. I said, "Mr. Redmond, your blood pressure is 160 over 110. You're going to have a stroke. You need to do some stuff, and you need to lose weight." And I said, "You know what? I would like to do that. But I drink alcohol and smoke marijuana before I go to bed every night, so I'm not going to be able to." And the doctor said to me, why don't we prescribe some medication for you? And I said, what a country. And he prescribed chloral hydrate for me, which is a fast-acting knockout drop. It's like a Mickey. It's like what they slip into the drinks of unruly sailors in 30s films. You know, they drink it and fall back like a piece of masonite. That's chloral hydrate. And I love these pills. I love, love, love my knockout drops. So Nancy comes home. I'm eating handfuls of knockout drops and standing in the hall, slamming my arms into the wall to keep myself awake to enjoy my knockout drop. Because you don't want to waste a perfectly good knockout drop. So I'm eating pills, slamming body parts into the wall until I just seize, keel over. Now I'm up in bed. Now I'm incontinent like the rest of the 33-year-old men in America because I got so much Mickey in me, I can't get up to go to the bathroom. And one night I got up and wet the wall. And the next morning Nancy was like excited. He wet the wall. He's headed towards the bathroom. This is great. You know, it's progress, not perfection, for God's sake. She made me a big breakfast, which I ate and puked up, you know, right away. And it was like, she was like a Wheaties morning in our home. Dad wet the wall. And oh, man. By the time I got sober, our sons had been horribly injured. Their small motor skills were screwed up. They were cut off from the society of other children. They could barely read or write, years below their grade level, and there was nothing organically wrong with them. They were so distracted from being scared all the time, they couldn't put small tasks together. I hadn't read our literature. I didn't know about the warped lives of blameless wives and children. I didn't know about the thinking that becomes hardwired. And it's right there in the second and third chapters of our book. What's the use anyhow? What's the use anyhow? Man, so that's where my sons, the world my sons lived in. What's the use anyhow? Or become pointlessly aggressive en route to a goal that never gets attained, ever. You either fight at windmills or you throw in the towel. It's a horrible way to live, and it eats away at a kid's heart. And how much, you know, when my children got in between me and the drink, they disappeared or they became papier-mâché figures, which means they became something less than human. And how much vanishing can a baby bear before the baby believes it? They just disappear. And this is the horrible state that my family was in on April 22nd, 1985, when I crossed the line I swore I would never cross again. I put a needle in my arm again. Why not? It was time, you know. And I called my therapist of record in my 18th year of psychotherapy, my first Jungian therapist. And I had told him what I had done. And he said to me that morning, I didn't know it. I didn't know it till I came in and I read our literature. He said to me the exact same thing virtually that Carl Jung said to the man who 12-stepped the man who 12-stepped Bill Wilson. If you're new here, I want to urge you when you get clear enough or you're okay enough to read some of our literature, to read the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, because it really simplifies AA. I had guys putting their finger on my chest saying, that's the way AA is, that's the way it's always going to be. And you know what? I didn't hang out with those guys. Alcoholics Anonymous was founded by a bunch of acid-dropping, niacin-eating, Ouija-board-playing wackos. Alcoholics Anonymous was founded by true seekers, incredible spiritual seekers. And I love it, because those are the people I've hung out with all this time. The people who have growed me up in the 11th step. And but not that morning. That therapist said to me, there's absolutely nothing that can be done for you. And I said, what? He said, the only thing I can suggest is we have you institutionalized. And then he said the thing that Carl Jung couldn't tell Roland Hazard. He said, or you go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous or Narcotics Anonymous. Now, why I went to the AA meeting, I don't know. Most other days, I would have gladly gone to the mental institution. Right? That's better than dental surgery. That's an uninterrupted source. That's like dental surgery with a cot. and that's an uninterrupted source of narcotics for a period of time. Well, I went to the AA meeting, I don't know, but I did. I woke up at 5 o'clock in the morning. I got my best clothes on. I got a bad check to write you. And I went to a place called Unit A in the deep San Fernando Valley. And I walked into this room, and I took a look around, and I said, oh, my God, how did I wind up in Alcoholics Anonymous? How lame is this? This is beyond lame. This is beyond church, beyond synagogue. This is some plateau of lameness I never even imagined was available to me. And the room looked like it was like the product of 200 years of inbreeding to me, right? There were like identical twins carving their initials on each other's feet in the back of the room, or so it seemed to me. And everything was a miracle. I'm a miracle. You're a miracle. I'm a miracle. The furniture and coffee are miracles. Oh my God. And then the AA unsolicited information guy, he caught me at the end of the meeting. You know him, right? Right? He's got a belt buckle large enough to serve an entire fish on. Do I want what you've got? No. No. And I'm waiting for the Jew hunt to break out, right? I know that's going to start any minute, right? Come on, Jaime, strap these antlers on. Always wanted to run a big buck Jew. Come on, we'll knock his beanie off. When he picks it up, we'll push him over. It'll be fun. I shared this at Sheila's group, which was in Oklahoma a couple of weeks ago, and the belt buckle thing didn't go over real big there. Started hearing gun racks rustle and stuff. They almost had a Jew hunt that night, as a matter of fact. But you like me. I hated Alcoholics Anonymous. I hated everything about it. I went back to that meeting every morning for a year. And I'll tell you why I think I did. I was out of plans. I was just flat out of plans. And if you're new here, I pray for you that you're out of plans. If you're new here and you have a plan, it's probably a butte. Don't use your plan. Grab one of us after the meeting and tell us your plan. We want to know the plan. My favorite newcomer plan, the single most utilized newcomer plan I've seen in my years in AA, is the one more dope deal to set myself up financially for sobriety plan. I'm getting heads. You don't get that at the Rotary. I was just out of plans, and I came back. My wife reached out to the Al-Anon family groups when I was after I was a month sober, and I don't need her to be an Al-Anon, but man, I sure appreciate it, because I have no idea what our lives would be like without it. I live with somebody who's seeking a spiritual solution in their life. That's really the beginning and the end of it, you know. And I was bringing nothing. I had nothing to bring to my marriage. Nothing. I didn't know how to fight. I would either scream until she shut up, or I would cry until she shut up. Either one's fine. I like the tyranny of helplessness. I always have. It's always worked for me. I like the loom. I'm a loomer. I'm big. I like to get a light behind me so I get her in a shadow when I loom. It's like total eclipse of the Jew if I get her like right, just right. And if I could get like a scream, a cry, and a loom into one fight, that's a hat trick. It doesn't get a whole lot better. I'm going to give you the Scott Redmond Couples Workshop right now. Take me 11 seconds. Here we go. Talk to her until she changes her mind. Just keep talking until her eyes roll back in her head and she keels over. And on the way over, she goes, oh, okay. That's what I'm bringing. I got nothing. I'm like a five-year-old. I don't even clean up after myself. I don't know that grown men clean up after themselves. I think somewhere in the back of my twisted brain that a certain amount of housework should equal a certain amount of sex. That there should be like conversion tables on the back of cleaning products of housework to sex. This is what I gotta tell you, anytime that I share this, there's always a couple of guys that go, okay. First, she busts herself for being in the witness protection program, and now she throws him under the bus. Unbelievable. And you guys said for us, you told Nancy and I not to get involved in our first year, and we didn't. We really needed to stay the hell away from each other. Um, one of the most detrimental defects of character to me, before I got sober and since, that keeps coming up on inventories for me, is this defect of character of mind reading. I think I know what people are thinking. It's never good. I never think they're thinking really good stuff. Seriously, when I start this, it never goes, oh, drops on roses and whiskers on kittens. They're thinking I'm a dumb crap head who just screwed up and they need to be straightened out. I mean, that's usually, we're going kind of in there. My wife was so frustrated one time, she said to me, you're not a mind reader, you're barely a mind user. I was 6 months sober and I asked a guy to sponsor me because I knew I was going to drink and I didn't want to. And he worked this 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous with me and he changed my life. And at 9 months of sobriety, I read him my fifth step. And I felt like I stopped stealing somebody's chair here. And I didn't know what I was going to do my eighth and ninth, except for the stuff that was really clear. Like, I'm sorry and here's the check. There's not a big mystery there. The mystery to me was what I was going to do about my dad and my wife and my kids. There were other mysteries, but that was the big one. And my sponsor said, he refused to tell me what to do. Thank God. He said, just do your job in AA. And I started doing my job in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I started showing up for my kids and going into the school and advocating for them because they had terrible problems in school. You know, I started being a husband. You know, I remember one time I did something for my wife. She said, what are you doing? I said, I'm trying to be of service. She said, well, this is a marriage, not a coffee commitment. And so I didn't use that word after that. She really wanted me to get involved in her home group, which is our home. And she's right. You know, that. And when you're new, you're finding a new language and it's working and you don't got to do anything, but it sure helped. At any rate, I started advocating for my kids and showing up in their school and sitting down with teachers who were angry and frustrated with them because they had all this potential and the teachers thought they were squandering it. They didn't know that my kids weren't squandering it. So I sat down and said, my children have been sick because they've been living with me and I've been terribly ill and we're making a beginning. Can you help us? No one ever said no. They said, of course, we've got all these resources. Let's test the boys, let's see what's going on. And God, that's fun. And they started special ed courses, and the teacher said, well, let's take care of this small motor thing. Let's do some big motor stuff. Let's get them into sports and music. And, you know, we were a family that couldn't get it together to register our kids for Little League or, you know, buy them the right pair of jeans. We're not talking about a lot of dough. I'm talking about a couple of bucks just so your kid doesn't go to school feeling radioactive, you know. And Jesse wanted to play drums, and I didn't have any money. But I tell you, I went to the drum shop, and I said, I don't have a few bucks. My kid wants to learn how to play drums, and they give you a drum pad. It's a piece of wood with a piece of rubber and a couple of sticks, so your kid can start learning from a book. And I went back to my home group, and I told the guys what I'd done. And I'll tell you why I told them, and if you have this kind of home group, not because I was bragging, because they wanted to know, because they were really interested in our family, because they were rooting for us, you know? And I was really proud of what I had done. And within 3 months, the AA drum set showed up at our house. There were a lot of burnout drummers in our group at that time. And these guys are showing up with these Megadeth drums, you know, dude. And Jesse had a drum set so big you couldn't see him when he sat behind it. He was just this gigantic thing. And a couple of years ago, both of my sons played the House of Blues on the Sunset Strip in L.A., and they burnt the dump down. Burn it down. Burn it up. Burn it up. Playing hip-hop music to this packed room, 800-900 people, these two gorgeous men, you know, and over to the side was this group of weeping middle-aged alcoholics. You know, the kids are going, what is with the crying old people, man? What the hell is that all about? And it's their AA and Al-Anon aunts and uncles that have been following them around. At that time, it was for 17 years, you know. And I was in my first year of sobriety. I was kind of becoming a spiritual Goliath. I was sponsoring guys at the end of my first year. I was very active. And I got an overture. Was being considered to be the director of a situation comedy, a staff director, which is a really good job. And I really thought at that time that if I got this job, it would be so good for the guys I sponsor. You know, they would just see the program at work, and they would see me prosper thusly, and it would be so good for them. And I directed one episode and almost drank because I didn't get the job. And I was humiliated. I went to my sponsor, I told him what had happened to me, and he said to me, "Well, I guess you have the show business God." I said, "What?" He said, "Well, I guess you have the show business. What keeps you sober?" I said, "God." He said, "Okay, God keeps you sober. You didn't get a show business job and you almost drank. So I guess you have the show business God. And he has abandoned you utterly." Now, when I came to AA, I heard God getting people in relationships, God getting people jobs, God getting people parking spaces. No, not the parking space God, not the parking space God. And if you have a parking space God and he gives you a space, pass it on. A bunch of years ago, my wife and I got really badly hurt in the Northridge earthquake. It's the last big earthquake in LA. We were in the epicenter, a guy died near us, I got a bad physical injury, the house got smashed up, it was bad. And shortly after the quake, I went to an AA function, Nancy and I went to an AA function out of town, and a woman came up to me who used to live in LA at this function, and she said to me, "I'm so glad God got us out of LA before the quake." And I said, "Oh, he likes you. Oh, he likes you. That is so great. But we're crap. But he likes you." And she said to me, "I guess he just felt you had some lessons to learn." I'm out of here. I can't stay sober in that world for 3.5 seconds. How could I possibly? Who the hell would want to stay sober in that world? Not me. I know it's keeping her sober. It ain't keeping me sober. If I got a God up there saying, "Get him, get him, get him, get the Redmond boy, get him. No evacuation plan for you, Jew boy, get him. Turn his wife to salt, kill his goat, put a finger in his eye, get him. Smote his ass, smote him. Smote anyone he talks to. We'll sort him out later on." That's a higher power I wouldn't be caught in a dark alley with. I sponsored a guy who had a child who was terribly ill. She was born very sick, and she was in neonatal intensive care, and she was in the same room with another adorable baby who was very sick, and that baby took her light into another room, and my sponsee's baby lived. And I want to tell you, I don't have a God. I don't have a God annihilating children. I just don't. I know this. This is the part of the mystery that I know because I have a primary purpose. My God expects me to do my job in AA if my children live or die. My God expects me to do my job in AA if it's to show a guy how to stay sober through a marriage that's working or how to go through a sober divorce. My God is not doling out. He's not going, "Let's key your car. It's boils for you. You're due for a rash." I just can't. I believe in the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the message is pure love. It's pure love. And the connective tissue that you see in this room tonight, if we can just blow on the embers of this connective tissue, because I want to tell you something. In 19 and a half years, my alcoholism has stayed above the horizon as a real piece of business because it's been buoyed on the heads and shoulders of the women and men of AA and the higher power that you've introduced me to. I used to be able to keep it up there on my own steam for a while if I fell in love, if I got fired, if something awful or wonderful happened. But on my own juice, it would always go down again. It hasn't gone down for 19 and a half years. And if you're new, dig this. Even when I'm not concentrating on it, because I'm not doing it, that's a miracle. So when I did my 10th step that day and I had to write that resentment against those people for not giving me that job. My sponsor said, when you do 6 and 7, when you draw close to him and he reveals himself to you, you're going to have to get a God big enough so a lot of stuff can happen and you don't get to drink. And I said, Pop, you take it. You take show business. I'm done. I'll do anything you want me to do for a living. Just keep me sober. And 3 months later, I was working as a cook on a catering truck. And I looked up to God and I said, I did not mean this. This wasn't even on the long list. What? Now in Los Angeles, when they make a TV show or a movie, they hire a caterer, you follow the company around, and you give them food, and it's you make a lot of dough. It's Teamster dough. You're on a vehicle on a movie set. But I'm Scott Redman. And the first TV show, the first movie that I cater, the executive producer and star of the movie was a guy who I had worked with in the industry. And he stuck his head on the catering truck that morning, and he said, can I have a burrito, Scott? And I said, what's happening, babe? And he said, is this your truck? I said, no, but it's my spatula. I called my sponsor when I got home that night, and I said, oh, I'm getting the gift now, I'll tell you. It's beautiful. And I want to tell you, man, I wound up serving people on this catering truck that I had been, that had been my assistant directors, had been stage managers on shows I had directed, a lot of actors who I had directed in TV shows. And I would come back to it with a new tale of humiliation of my home group every week, and the guys would just go, oh, come here, listen to this. And I wrote that 10-step, and I wrote that 10-step. I'm resentful at those people. I'm resentful at me. And what are the defects? I mean, the defects, again and again, would be impatience, false pride, shame, guilt, ungrateful, not living in today. And I showed up, and I learned how to give them a dime for their nickel. One day, a guy on the set walked in. He had been my assistant director on the last show I had directed. And I went and I hid around on the other side of the truck because we were at the part of the meal where the caterer cleans up, and I was filled with garbage. And I went and I hid around the truck, and I knew it. I knew it because it was the last paragraph of chapter 3. The time and place will come. And this is how it demonstrated that morning. I said, Scott, you will either hide behind this truck for the rest of your life, or you will go out and do your job, which today is cleaning up the garbage. And I knew it. And I knew that it was that it was big. And I did it. And when I cleared up the garbage, and my friend Lenny saw me, and he was happy to see me. And because I was free of mind reading that morning, I didn't hear his thinking, which would have not been good for me. He would have not have been thinking, wow, how can I get to do that for a living? That's not what his thoughts would have been. Mind reading has never been good for me, Scott Redman. At any rate, I don't even think it worked out for Dionne Warwick, personally. Hey. At any rate, I got to help some people who had felt they had fallen from a height in AA. You know, I had this one friend, Paul, and he'd say this prayer. He'd say, Pop, I'm willing to do anything for a living. Just keep me sober, but please don't let it be as bad as what you did to Scott. And I cooked for about 3 years. My son Jesse asked me to teach him how to cook, and that's something that he and I have been doing his whole life and together, and it's part of our beautiful relationship. And that's not how I would have chosen how to be intimate with my son. You know, he calls me long distance, and I still talk him through sauces and stuff like that. That's not how I would have chosen to have this beautiful thing with my kid. And after about 3 years, I had an overture made to me by a company named Ketchum Public Relations, big PR firm in New York with this comedy writing job. And you know what? I really thought that if I got this comedy writing job, it would be so good for the guys I sponsor. Because they had seen me suffer, and now they would see me prosper thusly. It would be so good for them. So I had to do a videotape for these guys. And of course, I went mad. My brain blew up before I even found out about it. Wrote the inventory, read it to my sponsor. We had a good laugh. He maybe laughed a little louder than me. And then I found out I didn't get the job, and I was cool. I had already released it. And a couple of weeks after, I get a call to cater some commercials in the mountains above LA. Well, I hop in the
truck, and I get up there, and they give you a call sheet, which is a sheet with all the information about the shoot. And I get it, and I look at it, and I see that the commercials are for Ketchum Public Relations. I'm feeding them now. Now I'm feeding them. And I look at the end of the truck, there's a guy videotaping me. I said, what are you doing? He said, oh, we're taping the making of the commercial. He's taping my humiliation. He's going to go back to New York with the tape. They're going to look at it and go, is that Scott Redman with the meatloaf? Oh, my God. I go home and I call my sponsor and I said, oh, we're getting the gift now. Oh, yeah, we're really getting the gift now. And he said to me on the phone, he said, I guess God had enough writers and needed a few cooks today. And then he said, you know, Scott, you told God you wanted to work for Ketchum, and you forgot to tell him what you wanted to do. As long as they're having a good time, folks. I've had a lot of problems in sobriety. I know some people haven't, and I'm very happy for them. I've had a lot of problems. I've had an eating disorder and sexual problems and money problems and career problems, problems with my marriage, problems with my very adventurous sons. I've had a lot of problems. And I hang out with people who tell the truth about what they're going through, people with a lot of time who've had a lot of problems and walk closer to the light and don't get overcome by this narcotic of self-pity and seek a solution. What does it have to do with AA? Absolutely nothing unless you're going through it. Absolutely nothing unless you're going through it and you wake up so full of self-pity and self-revulsion that you don't know what kind of message you're possibly going to pass on to anybody. There's a wonderful story in our book called From Farm to City, where a woman talks about the love of her life, her husband, dying. And she had to go on a 12-step call within 24 hours of his passing, and all she could do was sit on the lady's bed and weep. Boy, it don't get any better than that, does it? You know? And what's happened for me is this process of sobriety, this beautiful golden opportunity, has been the opportunity for me to implement the 12 steps and the grace of God to try to keep these other things that have been troublesome to me above the horizon as a real piece of business so they don't slip below the line and I do things that are injurious to me or others. That's really been the process of rearranging my life to accommodate sobriety. And I can't do it unless I tell the truth. If you're new, I want to welcome you to AA. The good news is that our problem mainly rests in our mind. I don't know of any book about recovery from a fatal illness that contains the sentence, we absolutely insist on enjoying life. There's no book about cholera that says, cholera is a hoot. It's just a hoot. You'll meet other people with cholera. It's fantastic. And then you'll meet people who just caught cholera. It doesn't get any better than that. My sponsor used to say that AA was the only recovery from a fatal illness that left the sufferer in better condition than they were in before they contracted the disease. Pretty beautiful. And if you're new here and you are not drinking, you have faith. I will tell you right now, you are my hero and you have faith. I now know for me, there's a difference between faith and belief. My beliefs are not my faith. I believe in my beliefs. They make me feel good because I believe in them. Faith is something very different. It's the gorgeous, pure expression of step two. I've heard it described by one of my spiritual advisors in a perfect way for me, that faith is to expose yourself to the truth despite the consequences. And if you are drinking and making yourself available for this gorgeous thing and taking the whooping, then you are performing an act of faith which is extraordinary. And I love you, and I wish you God's good speed and all the luck in the world, because there's some luck involved here too, you know. The bad news is our problem mainly rests in our mind. Some years ago, I was at a meeting, I met a new guy, I went home and he called me and he talked to me for an hour. I said, uh-huh, four times so he'd know I wasn't dead. And he explained to me he had been stalking several women. He had a restraining order out against him, but he's different. He's 2 weeks sober, and it's different now. And At the end of the hour, he said to me, "God, I feel so alone." And I said, "What are you talking about? I hardly know you. I just listened to you for an hour without interrupting you. What do you mean you feel alone?" And he said, "Well, I don't have a woman." And I said to him, "What exactly would you be bringing to a relationship right now besides stalking skills? What are you bringing to the party right now?" People 2 weeks into remission from leukemia are not having dating problems. Alcoholics are, because our problem mainly rests in our mind. Some years ago, my wife was walking through our room, and she knew I was on the phone with a new guy, and she heard me say into the phone, "Let's say the aliens are coming." I said, "Look, man, I'm not saying that's an outside interest. They could be coming. I don't know. I don't know. But I have one question for you. Why are they coming for you? Why are they traversing a universe for your sorry ass? Why you? You have no life. You live in North Hollywood. You're 11 days sober. You're wearing Depends. Why? Why you? Don't you think they'll go to a post office or call a cop or something? Plus, he's sleeping with the Bible on his chest to ward them off. So they're going to traverse the galaxy, walk into his room and go, 'Oh no, the Bible, let's go home.'" So I'm sharing this at my home group like a couple of weeks after it happens, and the guy who it happened with walks in while I'm telling the story, and I'm watching the cat, right? I'm watching the cat, and he goes like this, he goes, the horrible memory came seeping back into him. If you're new here, I want to urge you as much as I possibly can to take this thing as seriously as you possibly can and go out there and have the time of your life. If the aliens are coming for you, welcome to AA, welcome home. God bless you all. Thanks for having me.